Det är tisdagen den 2 juni. Jag heter Peter Wennblad och du lyssnar på Ledarredaktionen, en podd från Svenska Dagbladet. Varmt välkomna hit. Idag så har jag en väldigt speciell gäst i studion och ett samtal som jag tror kan bli ganska känslosamt. Vår gäst har kommit hit från Israel, så från och med nu så kommer jag gå över till och prata engelska efter bästa förmåga. Eli Sharabi, my guest, has lived through something most people cannot imagine and even fewer can understand how one can get through with the will to live and the joy of life intact. In his own words, he has returned to the world from hell. On October 7, 2023, Eli was kidnapped from his home in Kibbutz Be'eri. For 491 days, he was chained and starved in Gaza, spending most of that time in Hamas underground tunnels. He was tortured, beaten, and humiliated. Every day was an endless longing for his family and a struggle to survive and keep his sanity. Just over a year ago, he was released and allowed to return home to Israel. There he was met with the news that his wife and two teenage daughters, whom he had longed for so deeply, had been murdered by Hamas terrorists on the same day he was taken away to Gaza. One of his brothers was also killed. Now he is in Sweden to speak about his book, On This Time in Captivity, Hostage, which was recently published in Swedish translation. It's a great honor to have you here, Eli. A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. I was not planning to go into detail about what you and your family went through on October 7, about the anguish hours in the safe room in your house, about how messages poured in from neighbors and friends saying that terrorists had entered your area, about when the terrorists entered your house and how you were taken away to Gaza and forced to leave your family behind. It's so well described in the book, and which I hope all the listeners will read. I would like to start the day before, October 6th. What was your life like?
Wow. We had a very peaceful family life in Kibbutz Be'eri, our piece of heaven. Our daughters was very, very happy girls living in the kibbutz. Lots of friends, lots of activities for them. Leanne and I just been very busy in our work as well, and happy from what we did. So lots of friends, great community, very supportive community, and I wouldn't do things differently.
How did you spend your last day as a family?
Actually, I've been, it was a barbecue in my garden with my friends, 15 friends. As usually, we meet together once a month, having a barbecue, having some conversations about things in the kibbutz. And I was very happy. Among them was my brother, Yossi, that was kidnapped as well on October 7 and murdered 100 days later in captivity. And after that, we had an evening. We had dinner as a family. Everything was normal. It was a holiday in Israel, and we didn't expect anything to happen on October 7th.
Because Be'eri is close to Gaza?
Yes, 3 miles.
You were used to rocket attacks, and during the years you lived there, there were several wars in Gaza.
Yes.
Could you ever have imagined that something like October 7 could happen?
No, we couldn't. As you mentioned, we suffered from 20 years. We suffered missiles from Gaza to Be'eri and all the south of Israel. every 6 months, every year, depending on the period. And we didn't expect any of what happened on October 7, that thousands of terrorists, Hamas terrorists, would invade Israel, our kibbutz, and our house.
But did you feel, I know you have, in the beginning, you were angry that you weren't protected?
I was disappointed. I wasn't angry. I was very disappointed from the IDF, of course. How come that, you know, thousands of Hamas terrorists succeed to pass the border without the intelligence, the Israeli intelligence couldn't know that. All days in captivity, I thought about it and how it can, something like that can happen to Israel. And, you know, but since then, I just heard what the IDF soldiers did in many, you know, battles area in Gaza with Hamas, in Lebanon with Hezbollah, with Iran, with the Houthi in Yemen. And I'm really, really proud of the Israeli soldiers. And that's it.
Let's return to the 6th of October, or actually when the terrorists enter your house. In the book, there's one haunting detail. When the terrorists get in your house, you get out of the safe room, your living room is filled with balloons.
Yes. Our daughter's birthday, it's October 1st and October 3rd. And all week, it was balloons in the house, her friends, cakes, and parties. It was Noya and Yehel's birthday, and they were very, very happy among the friends. And yes, and when the 10 terrorists invaded our house, it was balloon in the living room. Surreal, you know, situation. The fears of the eyes of my daughters was shocking. And Leanne didn't know what the next action to do. And I tried to calm them down. I was sure our plan that, you know, to say to the terrorists that they have British passport will work. Unfortunately, these terrorists didn't have any boundaries. They didn't care about anything. They just wanted to kill.
You're at the moment, even when you're taken out of your house, taken to the car that the terrorists have stolen from your kibbutz, you write that immediately you went from the Ely you were to Ely the survivor. What do you mean?
As I mentioned before, we had a plan for Leanne, Noya, and Yehel to be protected from their British passports. And we assumed that I would be kidnapped because I don't have a British passport. And so I was prepared to be kidnapped at the same day. And when they dragged me out of my house towards the fence and into the car, I was very focused. I could understand what I'm, you know, seeing. I was in shock or something like that. I didn't feel.
How could you not be?
Because again, I was very focused for me surviving and what I need to do, and I didn't feel any of the violence against me. They kicked me, they hit me, and I didn't feel anything about it from that. And I start to count minutes in the car from Berry towards Gaza to understand how far I'm from home. And it was something like half an hour, very slow drive. So I was, and I understood that I'm not that far from home.
During the first weeks in Gaza, you were held captive in a house by a family, if I'm right.
Yes.
But in November, in the end of November 2023,
yes,
you were moved on and down into Hamas tunnel system. You describe this as your worst nightmare.
Of course.
What did you know about? Why was it? You had some knowledge about this
yes,
beforehand.
Every Israeli could see before that Hamas tunnels. It was enough videos on television from you know some years before, so we understood how it looked like, and you know. Everybody, even if you wouldn't see any video of that before, you understand that to go 50 meters underground, it's not a big fun. And it's, you know, it was very, it wasn't easy to breathe properly, especially from the stress. It's all dark around you. It's only the flashes from their torches. Of the terrorist was a bit light, and so for me to climb down in these ladders was my worst nightmare. It looked like the perfect grave.
It's literally yes. Climbed down to hell.
Yes.
Life in the tunnels. Take us there. What was it like? Who were you with? How did you live?
In the beginning, it was some like seven or eight terrorists with us in the beginning. We've been a group of seven, me and another six Israeli hostages that was kidnapped from the Nova Festival. All of them were young, half of my age. Unfortunately, three of them were murdered 10 months later in other tunnel. We had, you know, we ate in the beginning two meals a day. A meal, it's not like something that you imagine. It's only a bowl of pasta or a bowl of rice. This is a meal. And, but it was two of that in the beginning. And hygienic condition was very poor. No soap, no toothpaste. Get shower every 6 weeks with half bucket of cold water. And lots of humiliation, psychological terror every day that all the Israelis forgot about us and we are going to stay there for 20 years and they are going to kill us one day and things like that. From time to time, of course, we were chained on our legs 24/7 with iron chain, with locks. Sometimes we were chained to each other, leg to leg. And... and this is our life, you know, and violence from time to time. One time they broke my ribs. And
were you afraid?
Yes, but you not deal with that because you cannot live in fear 24 hours a day. You're trying to avoid from these thoughts. But the worst thing, of course, was the starvation. That become very extreme in the last 6-7 months since July 24. They reduce our meals to one meal a day. And, you know, I was more than 70 kilos on October 7, and I was released 40 kilos.
You write about a lot about that, the last couple of months when you're starving, the whole group is starving. What does... constant hunger make to a man and what does it do to a group trying to survive together?
You see your friends because we don't have any mirror, so you don't see yourself, but you see your friends shrinking, and our physical condition were very poor and changed drastically. In the last 6 months, we start to faint almost every 2 or 3 days, holding in the walls not to fall down when we went to the toilet. Just, you know, every crumb that was on the carpet from the one meal a day, we start to pick up and thought that that's what's going to save us. to divide the food for four. You count every pasta, every rice, and it's not easy. It's you think you're going to die in every minute, and I believe that another month or two, if we wouldn't be released on February 25, we probably wouldn't talk now.
How do you keep together when you're four people? You're all struggling for your own life.
So you're trying to avoid every thought, every negative thought you can think of. You're trying not to think about food. Of course, you think you're very hungry. You try to speak about good things, about family and friends and travel you did in the world, and sharing your experience from that. And you're talking about everything that can take you from to the other world, and not to think where you're being and how filthy you are, and how you difficult for you to sleep, or your nightmares you have there, or and of course the hunger and violence against us and humiliation. You have a zero ego, and but you find good things between you and make the group stronger. It was we prayed every morning, and we are not religious, but we did it. And you know, you do everything you can that you can pass this hell, really.
When I read your book, it's like you're trying to arrange some kind of normal life in hell.
You have to, otherwise you'd be insane. You know, you're trying to keep your sanity in every way you can. Again, you're trying to persuade the captors to let you shower more times. You're trying to get some soap or toothpaste. Of course, you beg for food 24/7. You do everything you can to improve your situation, to keep your humanity, to think, to talk about your family, to everything you can to stay sane.
Mind traveling to other worlds.
Yes, of course.
You write, and you have also spoken a lot about afterward, that you did not only want to survive, you chose to survive. You chose life, and you choose life. Tell us about that. What does that mean?
Well, my basic instinct is to live. I love life. I appreciate life. I promised my daughters on October 7, when they drug me out of the house, I'll be back for them. I try to do everything to make this promise, and I came back, and it wasn't. I had no doubts that if it's built, you know, up to me, I will do anything to survive. And they actually need to kill me, you know, in their own hands, for me not to come back to my family, and. You need to stay patient, and you understand how this work. It's not pizza that you put in the oven for 15 minutes. It's not that easy. It's very complicated to release us. We understood that. We talked about it. So we chose life there, and we chose life after we were released. And each one of us went to his own tragedy. And some people lost their wives, some people lost their kids. But I still have amazing family that supports me, amazing friends, and I'm trying to rebuild my life.
Because it was the thought of your family that kept you going. It was the reason choose life in captivity. Then when you were freed, you found out that they were dead, murdered. How do you choose life when such a fundamental part of what was your life is gone?
I'm a very practical person, and it wasn't even one day in that 491 days in captivity that I didn't think that my wife and my daughters didn't survive October 7. It was one of the options. So when I was released and I was announced that they didn't survive that and they were brutally murdered by Hamas terrorists, you know, it was shock for me. It was very painful until now. And but again, it's something that didn't find me not prepared. And I just wanted to hug the rest of my family, my mother, my brothers and sisters. And we want to be together because we know that we support each other and this is our strengths as a family. And, you know, I think the best I can to honor the memory of my wife and my daughters is to live and to rebuild my life and to be happy.
In the end of the book, you there's a sentence you write that you have been at the bottom. You have seen it. You have touched it. How does it look?
So it's, of course, it's double meaning. I was 50 meters underground. I was in the bottom of the ground, in a very, very bad situation. And of course, for me, released and, you know, announced about my loss, about my wife, Leanne, my daughters, Noah and Yael. And 2 days, just 2 days before my release, I was announced about my brother, Yossi, that was murdered as well. And so for me, it's another bottom. And when I went to the graveyard a week after I was released, I touched these graves. It was a closure for me. It was the bottom of my life. I can't see something that can happen to me worse than that. And from there, I just need to rebuild my life and, you know, not to stay in this bottom.
No. In the first 2 weeks in the tunnels, one of the other hostages that later were murdered, he had a sentence that stick to you.
Yes, Hirsch Goldberg Paulin was amazing, intelligent guy. And I met him on November 27th, the day I was climbed down this ladder to the bottom of the ground. And after we knew each other and we told each other who we are surviving for, and he just said this sentence, that, you know, that is first originally it's from Nietzsche, and he read it in Viktor Frankl's book. And he said, he who has a why can bear any how. And at that moment, it just gave war to my behavior for 52 days until I met him. And for me, I didn't forget this sentence. For 440 days, every day we remind us to each other. The four hostages that stayed together, it was me, Elia, Oren, Dalon, because Hirsch, unfortunately, they transferred him, they moved him to other tunnel, and he was murdered 10 months later. We are thankful for this guy, for these words. He gave us a gift for the rest of our captivity time. And it's something I said to his father, And I read this, you know, of course, I wrote it in my book. It was very, very significant and meaningful for me.
As you said, these words are from a book by Viktor Frankl.
Yes.
He was a Holocaust survivor from from Austria. When I read your book, it reminded me of much of the survivor literature from the Holocaust. Viktor Frankl, I have with me here Primo Levi. I don't know if you read him. It was an Italian survivor who also wrote a lot about remaining human when you live like an animal. Did you have an... I know that to remember is a sacred duty in Judaism. You're pretty secular, but did you have a... I can imagine that as a Israeli and a Jew, you have a relation to the survivor literature.
Of course.
Did you think of it when you were down there?
Definitely. For me, you know, I didn't come from a family of generations that were in Holocaust, but every Israeli child in schools, in the army after that, we all remember the Holocaust, and we met Holocaust survivors in our life. In age 18, I was in Poland for 10 days in all these concentration camps and heard all the stories and heard a lot of testimonies from Holocaust survivors. So it stayed with you. It's with you. It's as Israeli. And you remember it every year, all day, or some of us. And when it happened to us...
Did it help you?
It helped us a lot because we talked about it 50 meters underground between us. If the Holocaust survivor could do it, could have done that, you know, to survive years in extreme condition, much more than us. And they did it for years without a country to defend them, without any army to that can defend them as well. And if they can do that, we can do it. It's, you know, it would be easy for us. That's what we said. We cannot be, you know, to be spoiled and complain about our situation. If they survived the Holocaust in Europe for years, we can do that as well.
You actually write about Sweden in one passage of the book. Do you remember?
No, remind me.
You write about that the Hamas terrorists that held you in captivity there. So they want to make the October 7th again and again.
Yes.
And when they're done with Israel and when done with the Jews, it's Europe, it's France, it's Germany, and you mentioned Sweden.
Okay, yes, because, you know, for us, Scandinavian countries, for the Israelis, usually it's like they never really, really understand what it's mean to live near, you know, in this conflict and with people that all their aim, all their goal is to destroy you and kill you. And so I had many conversations with them. I'm speaking Arabic. And in every conversation with this terrorist, they repeat all the time. It doesn't really matter. We could start from football to speak or about food. And it's always ended with these two sentences. We come back on 26, 27, 28 to kill all the Israelis, all the Jews. And after we finish with the Israelis, the next thing we'll do, we come to Europe, we come to US. And because the only religion should be in the world, it's Islam. And all the world should be Muslims. And that's the only thing. This is jihad for them. And this is their goal.
What political conclusions have you drawn from what you were forced to experience?
You know, me being a former hostage and having this extreme loss of my wife, my daughters, and my brother doesn't make me an expert about this conflict and have all the solutions and all this.
But for you,
I've been with them 24/7 and I could hear them and listen to them. And I understood how much ignorance it's they have. It's about Israel and Israelis. And I remember that one of the captors in the house after something like 30 to 40 days in the Palestinian family house, just being with me. And we had, you know, a respectful relationship. I respect them, they respect me. And he said to me in a second that I couldn't understand, I couldn't believe he says that. And he said, I wish all the Israelis would have been like you. And I said to him, you know, 90% of the Israelis are like me. I'm not talking about the radical 10%. I don't care about them. Most of Israelis don't care about them. Most of Israelis, and I believe that most of Palestinians, want to wake up in the morning, go to work, come back to their families, want to go to their children with to the beach and to the playground and just have a peaceful and normal life. And he looked at me and he says, I don't believe that. And then you understand that the education they get in schools, in mosques, it's to hate most of the time. And when they meet me for 24/7 and see that I can respect them and talking with them about economics, about food, about politics, but respect them, they don't believe that.
When you were freed, you did a lot of work to get the last hostages free.
Yes.
For example, you were in the UN Security Council just a couple of weeks after you got free. You were pretty angry at the UN, at the Red Cross, at the world.
Yes.
Where were you?
Yeah. What? Yeah, you know, when I was released, all you could hear about starvation in Gaza or something like that, and I says, please just look at in the ceremony of February 8, 2025. It's on television, on video. It was all filmed by the Arab networks. You can see me, 44 kilos. You can see all the rest of the terrorists and civilians around this stage, thousands of them. If you can see someone in my condition, I will give you whatever you want. Just mention one in my condition. You know, it's so hypocrisy to speak all the time about something like that. What is the Red Cross job to do? If not in situation like that, they can be in both sides. I expect them to be for the Palestinian prisoners. They are terrorists that did loads of bad things to Israelis. They are in jail in Israel. Come to visit them, see their conditions, and come to visit me. I was almost 500 days and nobody was came to see if I'm okay or not. So so if it was anger, that's fine.
It sounds like that you're still angry and disappointed about this.
Of course. Well, the world is hypocrisy. When it's come to Israel, it's always a double standard. And it's awful. Of course, I'm angry about that. I will always, defend my country, our soldiers. And if it's, you know, you can see this injustice in the world about us, and it's crazy.
Have you met the Red Cross and talked about this?
Well, no. except of February 8th, I haven't seen anyone from the Red Cross. And of course, I've been in the UN. Every place I'm invited to speak and say my testimony, I'm coming and do it.
In Sweden, like most Western countries, during all these days you were in the tunnels, there were not much expression of support on the streets of Europe, but there were manifestations, demonstrations every week. In Sweden's third largest city, Malmö, people were, hundreds of people were even celebrating on October 7th.
Crazy. Just crazy.
I guess you have, when you got free, you have heard about how you got a lot of support from Israel, from the Israeli people, but outside Israel, not so much. What is your feelings? Do you feel betrayed by the Red Cross? Do you feel betrayed by the world?
Well, I'm not expected much, not from the UN, not from UNRWA, not from the Red Cross. I'm not expecting so much from them, and it's ears by ears at this double standards about Israel. Again, you know, people cheering on October 7 when my family, my wife, my daughters, that haven't harmed anyone, and with their British passport in their hands, been murdered 5 minutes after I was kidnapped, shot dead in their head in our house. It's crazy how someone can cheer something like that happened. I never cheered when innocent people in Gaza been hurt or wounded, when Israeli are trying to hit terrorists in Gaza that hiding behind their own population. But again, when innocent people get hurt, it's always hurting for me. And so someone cheering when hundreds of young kids have been slaughtered in this Nova festival, girls was raped, families been brutally murdered in their houses. Just crazy. Crazy. How can you be a human being to cheer or something like that?
That's a good question.
Yes, I know.
I know that you're not into politics. You just have your own opinions. But if you could decide, what does Israel need to do to ensure that what happened on October 7 never happens again?
First of all, the Israeli government should investigate, ordered about a committee to investigate what happened on October 7. And then we can all start and, to learn from that and get conclusions that it will not happen in the future again, because something was wrong. It shouldn't happen like that. That's not the result you expected from, with a great army and great intelligence, with all the abilities they have, that something like that happened. So we need to investigate that. And I wish we'll not have, these things, in the future. I wish we can reach, with peace agreements with our neighbors. And one day we can live without wars in our area. That's what
Do you hope, or do you think that Israel will...
No, I hope. I always hope. I don't know what if it's possible now. I know it's very, very difficult, and it's look like far, far in the future. But I always live in hope.
Choose hope.
Yes, of course. Otherwise, why we live in this world? We don't live to have wars. Always live in hope that we'll have a better future for the next generations.
I know your brother got involved in politics in Israel.
Yes, he's crazy enough. Of course.
It's not something you consider?
No way. No way. It's not for me. I'm happy with my life. I just want more time for myself. I was released 15 months ago. I hasn't stopped since then. You know, travel around the world and advocating for the hostages and for Israel and speaking about this book and make my promise to my wife and my daughters that I will not let anyone to forget them. But I need a rest. I need to come back to my friends, my family, do something, you know, things for myself, open my day in the beach, walking on the beach. Yeah. It can be great. Especially not to work in politics.
As you said, since you were freed, you've been on the on tour almost. Yes. In some way, you can say that you left the tunnels, but you have stayed there.
I can't say that I stayed there. I promised to myself I can do everything. You know, for me, joining my family's battle for bringing back my brother's body from Gaza, it was automatically without, you know, no question about that. I left a friend, Alon Oel, on the, you know, 50 meters underground. I promised him I'll fight for him until we'll come back home. And, you know, I was in touch with his family from the first moment I was released, and I try not to leave them until the last minute he came back. So it's something that, you know, these values I was raised from, you know, by my parents, and we raised with these values as a family. And you learn these things, you know, in the army as well. You never leave friends behind. So I didn't mean to do that. I don't feel I walked in that. That was my mission. And I've tried to do everything I could to do it.
Are you worried of going back to a normal life?
No. I love normal life. I want normal life. I would be very happy to have it in the near future. You know, me speaking about my loss, my captivity time, October 7, nonstop, really nonstop. It's probably one of the reasons I don't have any PTSD. So I'm fine. I don't have any nightmares. I'm a very strong man. I'm capable to rebuild my life. I need a new start, and I will do it.
If you imagine an ordinary day in 2 years.
Okay.
What do you hope for?
Wow. Me on the beach in Thailand, scuba diving, do it for my youngest daughter that she really promised her. She just finished on August 23. Our scuba diving course, I promised her that I will take her to Thailand to dive with me. So for me, doing these things, it's, you know, do things for the memory of my family. I'm trying to do it every day. We are building a new center of in Israel for kids with special needs. That's what my oldest daughter did, volunteered with these kids with special needs. So I'm trying to do this stuff, and, you know, and their memory will be alongside of my life, all my life until the rest of my day. You know, and for me, it's a part of my life now, but not instead of my life. So it will be with parallel lanes, normal life and the memory of my family.
Elisha Rabi, thank you so much for joining
me. Thank you for having me.
Ett stort tack också till er som har lyssnat. Du har lyssnat på Ledarredaktionen, en podd från Svenska Dagbladet. Ni är som vanligt varmt välkomna att höra av er till redaktionen med tankar och synpunkter på det vi precis har pratat om här eller idéer och förslag på saker vi borde ta upp i framtiden. Det är bara att mejla till ledarsidan @svd.se. Tack för idag. Producent har vanligt Jesper Sandström, ansvarig utgivare Lisa Irenus. Jag heter Peter Wennblad. Tack för idag.